Commissioner of Internal Revenue Service. Are they all here? Mr. Jones?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. Gentlemen, we have two cases.
I understand.
The fifth case and the sixth case. We do have one common issue among both cases, and we will, of course, treat that however the court would like us to treat that, although there is one distinctly different issue.
Yeah, I know, but if we're just going to take the fifth and sixth case, right? This one's...
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't care how you present it, just do them one at a time. You want to do the same issue, obviously we're all going to be here. So you may proceed.
Thank you.
Good morning, gentlemen. May it please the court. Good morning, Ms. Ketchum. With respect to the case of the Bradleys, as with respect to the other case, there is one underlying issue which the appellant sees as not having been decided by this court or meaningfully by any circuit court. The construction of the collection due process hearing statutes and how far they should apply or what they are entitled to give a taxpayer after the taxpayer has received an assessment from the tax court. Now, in the case of the Bradleys and in the case of the Kindreds, the appellants are arguing, and we submit the proposition is, that a matter involving the expiration of any applicable statute of limitations is not a matter of the substance of the underlying tax liability. It is procedural. In the case of the Bradleys, the expiration of the statute of limitation that we're speaking about deals with the expiration of the time to make the assessment following the entry of a decision in the tax court. So it certainly couldn't have been raised during the process of the original tax court proceeding.
Was the original tax court proceeding determination of the amount owed?
The original tax court proceeding was a determination of the amount owed by statute under our interpretation of the law that the IRS, which does not make an assessment until there is a final determination either by default or by the tax court, by statute, the IRS was precluded from making the determination until there was a decision. By statute, the IRS is required to make a determination within 150 days following the entry of the tax court's decision. The 150 days in this case is because the taxpayers have waived their right to appeal that decision on the merits, and they've waived their right to defer collection, which is normally a 90-day proposition following the entry of a tax court decision before it becomes final. Following the finality of a tax court decision, the IRS has 60 days by statute to enter an assessment. None of this could be raised during the tax court proceeding because the error by the IRS didn't occur until after the tax court proceeding. And
what,
as a matter of...
What's the error after?
The error is the failure to enter the assessment within the period prescribed by statute, which is...
Is that a technical error, something that just already was...
No, it's just that... Excuse me, Your Honor.
Something already determined but just didn't do? Or what?
They didn't make the... They didn't enter for 7 months. They didn't enter the... They didn't make the assessment.
So they didn't know how much?
They knew how much. It was entered in the tax court decision.
Yeah, so what took 7 months?
Evidently, they just made a mistake.
Okay, so it's this...
They just let the statute with respect to entering the assessment, they let the time lapse.
So what?
They
that
made
mean?
A mistake. They were negligent.
What's that mean as far as your client's concerned?
What that means is that any assessment entered after that period is barred by the statute of limitations.
So
it can be raised in a collection due process hearing.
So they don't owe anything?
Not anything for that year. Any more than if the IRS had not brought a proceeding in the first place against the client. And the 3-year statute or the 6-year statute of limitations had run since the filing of the tax return.
So this is a technical violation that you think has the IRS has goofed up and therefore cannot collect this?
I wouldn't determine it a technical violation. It's a real violation. The IRS does this often.
Well, I mean,
and it's a statutory
real. It's technical in that it's a procedural violation.
It's a procedural violation, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's not a substantive violation.
Okay.
And I believe it should have been considered in the collection due process hearing and considered by the tax court judge in the summary judgment motion. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Ketchum?
May it please the court, my name is Sarah Ann Ketchum and I represent the commissioner in this proceeding. Actually, Mr. Jones didn't advance one of the arguments he made in his brief, which was he had argued that even where the taxpayer was prohibited...
Taxpayer was what?
Prohibited from raising the merits of the liability under 6330C2B, which says that the taxpayer may raise the existence or amount of the tax liability, but only if he did not get a notice of deficiency or otherwise have an opportunity to contest the amount of the deficiency before assessment. And in this case, clearly the taxpayers did have an opportunity to challenge the amount of the deficiency. So there are two questions in this case. One, are they prohibited from raising any issue about the existence or amount of the deficiency because they did get a notice of deficiency? And second, is the statute of limitations argument a procedural argument or an argument about about the existence or amount of the liability? The before 6330 came into effect, and that was in 1998, there was a scheme of tax litigation. And that under that scheme, consistently, statute of limitations on assessment was an issue that was raised together with as an issue about the existence or amount of the tax liability. That is, it can be raised in a deficiency proceeding. There it's sort of a there the question is whether or not the notice of deficiency was issued within the statutory limit, but it also can be raised in a refund proceeding in a district court.
But that's the first encounter, either in tax court or in federal court. Either way, either you pay part of it and then challenge to get it back in federal court, right?
Right.
And then in tax court, you go in...
Before assessment and payment.
So, and we're in the tax court realm, aren't we? Where are we?
In this case, in Brandley, the taxpayers stipulated to a decision in the tax court.
Okay, so they showed up for that at least.
Yes.
Okay.
So they have a decision in the tax court. It's res judicata. And they can't challenge the amount of the deficiency.
Right.
Now, on the other hand, arguably they could challenge the statute of limitations issue in a refund suit.
Well, once you initiate the tax court, is a refund suit available?
In limited cases.
Well, what about here?
Actually,
I want you to straighten this out here because this is pretty muddled. And I would just like a succinct step-by-step of what should have been done, what wasn't done.
In Bradley. They should have, in order to raise the statute of limitations issue, raise it in a refund suit.
Initially?
No. No, not initially.
You mean you'd have two cases?
6512A prohibits, once you've filed a petition in response to a notice of deficiency, prohibits the taxpayer from bringing a refund suit except in certain cases.
Is this a certain
case?
One
of the exceptions is statute of limitation.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that didn't happen in this case. I know there's a distinction, but I want you to go through it. What he's complaining that it's because the assessment wasn't made for 7 months or whatever it's called.
But that's not there. There is no requirement that it be made. I mean,
all right. Well, tell us about that. I really mean it. Let's
the statute
get
of limitations.
What should have been done and what wasn't done? Just let's walk us
by
through
the
it.
IRS. The IRS assessed it within the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations is in 6501A1. It's 3 years after the taxpayers file their return. There's no dispute in this case
that
it was assessed within those 3 years.
And they stipulated that or did something.
Right.
Okay,
next 6503 suspends the statute of limitations after a notice of deficiency is issued. It does not. He is arguing that it creates a new statute of limitations. All of the courts that have addressed this issue have rejected that argument.
Okay.
And they rejected it back in the tax code of 1926.
So what's the next step after the tax court in this assessment and stipulation?
Okay. Then the assessment is made, a notice is sent to the taxpayer, and if the taxpayer doesn't pay, then there's a lien, and then the IRS can do a levy. But in order to do a levy, now the IRS has to give the taxpayers an opportunity for a collection due process proceeding.
And they didn't respond because it came too late, they say.
No, they didn't. They did respond. They did. They did bring a collection due process proceeding, but the only issue they raised was a challenge to the existence or amount of the liability.
Going back to step one, you mean?
That is the only issue that they raised in the collection due process hearing.
All right, the CDP hearing, whatever it's called, they raised the issue of the original assessment of the amount.
Yes, actually, the only issue that the taxpayers actually attached some protester type procedural arguments to their request, but they've dropped those. But they said mathematically incorrect on the form, and the only issue that their representative raised was the statute of limitations issue.
Does this have an underlying tax protester aspect?
Patrick can ask him.
Originally, apparently so, because they did attach some things that were, like the Form 17 argument that, the notice of assessment has to be on the Form 17, and there wasn't the correct assessment and those arguments. But they've dropped those, once they got Mr.
Jones.
Yeah,
we don't have that before us now.
Right. So Mr. Jones is not defending those. But apparently
this is what? What did you just say?
Mr. Jones isn't defending the tax protester arguments.
All right.
Right. So they dropped that once they hired him. So
once they had
at some point, apparently these taxpayers were...
Once they had counsel, those things fell aside.
Were advancing protester arguments. Well, actually, they had counsel in the district in the tax court proceeding because the stipulated decision is signed by a counsel. But our position is that, first of all, in any event, the IRS assessed this within the statute of limitations.
Was this Victoria Osborne an attorney?
No, I believe she's... Oh, you'd have to ask Mr. Jones.
All right. When you said there was...
No, she's somebody who works in his office, and I don't know.
All right.
The IRS did assess it within the statute of limitations. They can't challenge anything else about the underlying liability, not only because of the prohibition in C2B, but also because of res judicata 6512. So the only thing they could have raised about, even assuming that he can overcome the bar of 6512, well, 6330 C2B, then he would still have the problem that the taxpayers can't raise it because of res judicata and 6512. And the other issues, as we argued, they did not present them to the collection due process proceeding, and so therefore the tax court couldn't hear them because this is a review for abuse of discretion. The appeals officer can't have abused his discretion by failing to consider an issue that the taxpayers didn't raise.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
What else you got, Mr. Jones?
May it please the court, and first I would like to thank Ms. Ketchum because there have been no tax protester related issues in this case since I have been counsel in this case.
And we know, I noticed that there wasn't.
And there are none. That isn't what we do. What is being raised here, I believe, is a procedural issue. Ms. Ketchum has admitted that same issue could be raised in a refund suit. Until 1998, the Congress had not made a determination that the taxpayer was entitled to a second bite of the apple. The very reason for the existence of 6330 and 6320 are to raise issues with respect to the propriety of assessment and collection. That issue could have been raised in a refund suit. It can be raised in a collection due process hearing by the very language of the statute. Tax court decisions to the contrary, the tax court is attempting to legislate. There are no decisions from this court to the contrary. If my client could raise this issue in a refund suit, my client should certainly be able to raise this issue in a hearing that's specifically designed to give a taxpayer who does not have the ability to pay the tax and then go to court a chance to raise the procedural issue before the court.
Well, what is the initial encounter in tax court supposed to be then, where in this case, whether it's a stipulation or finding or something to the amount? Then your client was there, right?
Yes.
So what's the? So now you're just saying, well, they didn't. I don't know what I understand what about the time of the assessment, but at this tax court hearing where your client was present, there was a determination for an amount owed. Is that correct?
There was a determination for the amount owed, and we did not attempt to attack that determination.
Okay, so what's next?
On appeal.
Next is
that doesn't mean that the single determination of the amount owed amounted to a proper assessment.
Well, wait
a proper minute. Assessment can only occur after a tax court decision.
You think this collection due process hearing is like an appeal, where you can then challenge what the tax court determined?
You can absolutely challenge it from a procedural point of view, just as you could in a refund suit in the United States District Court, the appellee has admitted.
And the procedural point of view is that they issued the assessment too late.
Yes.
Okay.
And our procedural point of view is we believe that date is mandated by statute by 6503 and 6213.
And if they don't do it, then it's...
Then they've blown the statute of limitations, Your Honor.
It's erased. Okay. That makes your point.
Do you have any case law upholding your theory?
There is no case law on this point on either side in a circuit court of appeals or in the United States Supreme Court. There is case law to the contrary.
Isn't it rather obvious then?
It's never been challenged. What happened is many
people... In
other
words, you think if something hasn't been challenged, then that's the law.
Not when the statute that gave us this opportunity only came into being in 1998, Your Honor.
This seems very clear to me.
But only in 1998 was this right given to the taxpayers. The taxpayer had this right in a refund suit all along. In 1998, the Congress saw fit to change the law to allow the taxpayer to bring up these issues through the collection due process hearing process without having to make...
Do you have any support for your theory from any legislative hearings or in? That was the intent of Congress?
Your Honor, it is written into the law, in the plain language of the law.
Can you quote it for me?
Your Honor, I believe that it may be...
No,
in
can
the,
you quote it?
I can't quote it.
That plain language of the law that you said is quoted or from legislative hearings?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it appears in the government's brief.
You're talking about the statute?
Yes.
You think this plain
it says
language...
The taxpayer may raise any relevant issue relating to the unpaid tax, 6330C2A3. Deals, for example, with the offer and compromise. And the challenge, the only thing that's excluded from the challenge is whether we're disputing the amount of the tax in terms of the underliability, or we're disputing issues that were mandatorily required to be litigated in the tax court.
Okay.
And this issue is not either in a refund suit or under the 1998 statute.
Okay, let's complete this case. Let's go on to your next one. And
Your Honor, I have a couple things to pick up from the desk.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's Las Vegas.